On the 9th of November 1918, with a revolution underway in Germany, a new republic was declared in Berlin. The next day, German Chancellor Friedrich Ebert and General Wilhelm Groener, acting in the name of the Supreme Army Command, concluded the Ebert-Groener Pact. This saw the German army pledge to support the new republic as long as the government acted promptly against any leftist uprisings. Hello, my name is Gareth Edwards, and welcome to the Untitled History Podcast. Join me each week alongside world-leading experts as we take a deep dive into your favorite topics from throughout history. From the ancient world to the modern, and with plenty of historical rabbit holes in between, we'll cover famous and not so famous moments in history from all across the globe. The German military in the two world wars is endlessly discussed. Much less talked about is the Reichswehr, the military as it has existed in the era of the Weimar Republic. Yet the Reichswehr and its officers were critical to the Republic's survival and, in some ways, eventually to its fall. Today we're going to explore its fascinating history. And with me to do that is Dr. Christopher Dillon. So glad to have you here, Chris. Say hello.
Thanks very much for having me on. I'm delighted to be here. We've got a sister podcast called Reichs and Republics on modern German history, which I'm co-hosting with Katja Hoyer, the best-selling British-German historian. So we're hoping to live up to the very high standards that you've set. And
For people who don't know you other than the sister podcast stuff, Chris is a senior lecturer in modern German history at King's College London. He's a specialist in the history of Weimar and Nazi Germany. And so this, you were always, I say this a lot on this podcast, but you were always the perfect person to come on this podcast and chat about this, not least because this is very much an area, I think, where there's a lot of myths around it as much as anything else. And I will almost certainly inevitably recount some of those. And I'm looking forward to having them busted as part of that.
I gladly do that. Very gladly.
So listeners, before we continue, it's probably worth me setting the scene here in terms of what we're talking about and what we're coming into. And so after World War One, the Imperial Army was abolished, and that's abolished on 6th of March 1919, and that's ties in with the Versailles Treaty, which then limits the Germans to a force of 150,000 professional army and a 15,000 strong navy. And something I just want people to remember when you're listening to this is when we talk about the Reichswehr, we are talking about both those arms of the military and actually later on air forces as well. I think sometimes there's a tendency to just think we're talking about the army, and whilst the army is dominant, This is a cross-discipline, let's call it, force. But there's limits on the size and type of armaments that this new German army and the German Navy are allowed to have. And it's also overseen by a military inter-allied commission of control until about 1927. So a lot of the stuff and different things we're going to talk through today, I think it's always worth keeping in mind that this is an army that is, and a navy that are operating under certain restrictions. And right from the word go, that really starts to define how they're formed, doesn't it?
Yes. So the restriction of the Versailles Treaty winds up being 100,000 men in the final draft is a massive shock to German military culture. You know, it's been like a century where conscription and service for a while in the Prussian, then German armies has pretty much been the cement of society, and it's been the way that kind of Germans learned how to become men. And suddenly this is the rug is pulled away suddenly under the Versailles Treaty. It's a devastating shock to a society that has a very strong military tradition.
And particularly in amongst what we'd call the elite, the aristocratic classes and the associated sort of wealthier classes, because you're moving down from, I mean, at the end of World War One, you're looking at sort of 200, 225,000 officers in the German army. And that's down under the new Reichswehr structure, that you're down to less than 4,000 straight away.
Yeah, so this is it. Yeah, there's a lot of kind of suddenly unemployed senior figures with noble backgrounds, and it's a much kind of discussed phenomenon at the time. There's an idea that somehow that the Reichswehr, the Weimar era army, is a kind of a sanctuary for these old Junker warrior castes, but it's just much too small to carry out that particular function.
And that's something I've always found fascinating as well, because one thing you often encounter, particularly online with this, is, and I always feel it's a perception that the Wehrmacht is keen to push later on, the later sort of World War II German army, that sort of post-Hitler army, that whilst they had to sort of skinny down, the people who remained were the elite. They were the best officers. They were the best soldiers. And I never really felt that the actual army lists entirely bear that out.
Well, but the entirety of the kind of Weimar era army is sedimented in myths that are like the congeal around it that are put in place by the Wehrmacht, and especially after 1945. So you do get, you know, some bright, kind of talented thrusting officers are kept on, but others are just let go to the sidelines because they're not politically convenient to the army leadership. So after the Versailles Treaty, you've got really quite a small number of officers that are able to stay on. They have to stay in place for 12 years on the whole because the Versailles Treaty doesn't want the German army shimmying around the terms by having everyone involved for a small amount of time. So it's a complete kind of remodeling of the way that the apex of late imperial German society has to kind of negotiate, you know, who gets to go where. So it's a kind of very unsettling.
And you mentioned about the sort of the Junker thing, this idea that it becomes a sanctuary for a lot of those. I mean, on paper, effectively, their percentage as an element of that officer rank of that officer corps actually drops. I mean, I've seen numbers that kind of say that you're looking at sort of 30-35% in that World War One era and the pre Reichswehr army, but that's down to about 20% by that point. Would it be worth actually, maybe for listeners, do you want to give an idea of culturally then what it would have felt like, what the officer corps and the sort of the culture and the theoretical side was within the first few years of that new army?
Yeah, I mean, certainly in terms of the culture shock, so the senior sort of nobles, the Junkers, they retain their dominant position in a traditional redoubts of elite snobbery, so guard units and in cavalry units. But in total, only 100 senior nobles, so from the Junker background, hold a commission at all during the Weimar Republic, whereas when the old Imperial Army is demobilized at the end of 1918, you had 9,000 noble officers. So the idea that somehow that they're all able to shelter from the modern world and shelter from the winds of democracy in the Reichswehr is a myth. And one of a curious kind of phenomenon is of these displaced elite males become something of a cultural preoccupation in the Republic. So one of the most famous cabaret songs in the entire Weimar Republic is called "Handsome Gigolo, Poor Gigolo." Bear with me here. one of the lines is, "Oh, you gold-braided hussar, show me a smiling face. They pay and you must dance." And just to deconstruct this, in some of Weimar Berlin's fancier hotels and dance floors, affluent ladies were able to hire for the night what were called Eintänzer, sort of handsome male dancing partners. And particularly in demand were former officers from the Imperial German Army who were unable to find a kind of a civilian role. So the cabaret song like laments their descent into essentially, you know, kind of like selling their bodies to wealthy young men, which is an extraordinary gender inversion of norms in pre-Weimar Germany.
I'm really shocked that that's not an image that Hitler and co later lean into. I'm shocked. But I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? Is you get this kind of almost, I mean, we get it a lot coming up today online, everything. Everyone talks about the male loneliness epidemic and all of this. And we forget that similar social ideas or movements or theories come to dominate the press, the media and everything else at different times. And I think maybe it's worth us just dwelling a bit on what you mentioned earlier, which is this is a huge cultural shock to Germany, not just the army, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's a kind of the Wilhelmite society has been built around the army as it cements. So you've got at the very top, you've got the Junker people we've been talking about. So these are the traditional Prussian warrior elite families. But then in middle class households, the pinnacle of social aspiration for any kind of like respectable middle class household is to have the father or the son getting a commission as a reserve officer in the army. Suddenly, after 1918, this is completely swept away, and the army has very little capacity to provide this kind of a cemented aspiration for society.
So I talked in the intro a bit about the Ebert-Groener Pact. Do you want to talk a bit about what that is and how much of that is true versus how much of it isn't?
Yes, gladly. Yeah. So this is a telephone call that happens between Wilhelm Groener, who is the quartermaster general in the army at the end of the war, so the replacement for the better known Erich Ludendorff, and Friedrich Ebert, who is the first president of the Weimar Republic. He's a leader of the moderate social democratic movement, comes from the trade union, so these are two, these are, this is the apex of civilian society, and the second in command of the army. The top is Hindenburg, who stays out of all this for reasons we'll come back to later. So in this telephone call, allegedly, Groener promises to Ebert that he will protect the new socialist government, and in return, Ebert will do what he can to fend off Bolshevism and communism and protect the status and the ranks of German officers. Now, I'm extremely doubtful this actually amounted to a pact, and I see it more as an exchange of pleasantries over the phone. The first time it's described as a pact is 20 years later in the memoirs of Groener himself. And Groener at this time is under a cloud in Nazi Germany. He's seen as being a general who worked too closely with socialists during the war and then after the war. So he's trying very much in his memoirs to convey himself as having been like a hard-headed, far-sighted anti-communist all along. He's also hated by the Nazis, by the way, for banning the SA in 1932. And the idea that it's a pact in any kind of meaningful sense is also confounded by two little bits of evidence. Firstly, in December 1918, there's a big congress of what were called soldiers' councils. These are councils that are created in units of the German army during the revolution to push through the change and to make sure that this, you know, pillar of imperial society is kept in line. Now, they vote at their big congress in December 1923 to abolish military rank. So this is rather like the Petrograd Soviet claim during the Russian Revolution that soldiers should essentially be comrades. There should be no one who has a rank. Instead, they're elected to authority. So Ebert has failed here completely to protect the army from the encroachments of socialists who want to abolish rank. And then secondly, around the same time, and this is even more telling, the frontline troops that Groener has at his disposal are humiliated just before Christmas in Berlin when they're unable to evict a rabble of sailors from the stables of the Kaiser's former palace in Berlin. The troops that the army sends in, they lose 56 men to the rebels of Lebanon, and they have to sort of scarper away in some ignominy. So it's not really a pact. This is a retrospective construction, and it has no content either. So in that sense, I'm extremely dubious that we should be calling it a pact.
I always find stuff like this fascinating, and it's why I will, listeners, I will put my hand up and say that I absolutely baited Chris into that bit, because soldiers' memoirs are always fascinating, particularly German Army, Air Force, and naval ones within the war period and outside of the war period, because there is naturally a tendency to, you want to be the person who says, I predicted it right, I got it right, I was doing the thing that you all want me to do. And I think sometimes we can have a tendency to think that it was only after the end of the war that people were doing that. But it's always been a thing that happens in memoirs. And so it's just the occasional periodic reminder that seems to be becoming a feature of this podcast, that if you track something back and it goes, the first time it showed up, it was in this bloke's memoir, it's always worth to think about the historiography and think about why might that person have put it in their memoir to begin with.
Absolutely. This can lead to zombie facts that are like that transfer from one historical account to the next. Even in, you know, highly professional historiography, these things are going to burn on endlessly.
Oh, it's the footnote diving. I mean, you follow a footnote and find that's a reference to another footnote, to another footnote, to another footnote, and you get back to the original one, and it's absolute rubbish.
Absolutely.
At some point, I will do an episode on the absolute myth about black Lancaster bombers being prepared to potentially drop atomic bombs, which, if you do any of the historiography on it, all traces back to a single farmer referenced in a single local newspaper in about 1987. And you're just like, that is not a definitive military source on there being Lancaster bombers trained to drop atomic bombs. But yeah, I mean,
beautifully illustrated.
Yeah, I mean, myths and blurry history sort of leads us, I think, nicely into something else that people should think about when we're talking about this period, particularly when we're talking now, let's say we're talking sort of in that run up to 1923. So we're into a generally quite tumultuous period for the early Republic, where the Republic is very much reliant on some element of stability being provided by the Reichswehr. But at the same time, it can't entirely count on its loyalty, can it?
No, it can't. No. So we see in most infamously in 1920, there's a attempted kind of monarchist putsch that's known as the Kapp-Ludwigs putsch, in which elements of the German army are either involved or complicit. And the Ebert government appeals to the army to send troops to put down the attempted coup. And the head of the army, Einhard, is prepared to do this. But then General von Seeckt, who's in charge of the troop office that kind of allocates personnel, says, no, Reichswehr, do not fire on Reichswehr. And this means that the Ebert government has to scarper out of Berlin and that the Reichstag is briefly occupied by the putschers. So this is a pretty devastating example of disloyalty.
And this is effectively a right-wing coup. And I think that's very telling. I mean, partly it does allow that sort of little bit of that myth later on of going, well, if they'd been lefties, we'd have put them down. But it also does very much show that the Reichswehr's loyalty is conditional. And I think that's true something all the way through this entire period, all the way through this interwar period that nearly is worth remembering, is their loyalty is always conditional. The conditions might change. You know, what they see as the conditions for their loyalty changes. But despite it being a relatively small force for most of this period, politically, it's incredibly powerful still. It's still so closely tied into that, the German ethos and the German political setup, that it is impossible for the republic side, for the political side to ignore.
Yeah, I mean, throughout the period, I'd say that the German armed forces, or certainly maybe until 1934, they remain loyal to the abstract idea of the Reich rather than to the particular form of government. And that certainly to the Republic, the loyalty is conditional. This changes in 1934 when the German army swears an oath to Adolf Hitler personally as the Führer and commander of the armed forces. Prior to this, they had sworn an oath to the Constitution, but they sort of conceptualized the Constitution in a very abstract sense as something that could easily be changed if Parliament kind of adjusted its mind. So in 1934 onwards, it's less conditional. And I think assuming that the Wehrmacht after 1934 is partial in its commitment to the Nazi regime, in some ways laps up the narratives that is put around in the late 1940s about the Wehrmacht. So I think there is a meaningful change in the mid-1930s.
And I always think it's really interesting with that, because there has to be a sort of political drift within the leadership level or into that sort of anti-democratic element to be able to do that. Like you say, they've always been more loyal to the Reich. But something I know you've written in the past, which I like, is that for a good period, they're anti-republic, they're not anti-democratic. And the process of shifting that is also something that the Nazi Party almost themselves have to work out how they do. And we'll talk about that in a bit. I mean, what we should talk about certainly at this stage is the role that something that people may have heard of called the Freikorps. So these, we talked already that there's lots of people thrown out of the army that these people aren't around. That doesn't mean they just disappear entirely. So what you get is sometimes referred to as the Black Reichswehr, the shadow army. And these are civilian militias almost that form, particularly in those early periods, where ostensibly what they're saying they're there to exist is to enforce peace in a way in trouble, in a way that the Reichswehr and the state is unable to do at those stages. How much of what we consider to be history around that do you feel is myth versus reality in terms of their influence and their power early on in the Republic?
I think you're going to be unsurprised to hear that I find a lot of it pretty mythological. So just to clarify the leaders, so for your listeners or readers, the Freikorps are kind of volunteer formations that are organized, facilitated by the German army, and they are used to put down left-wing uprisings in Germany in 1919, in the early 1920s, and they also skirmish with kind of Bolshevik and Polish forces on Germany's eastern borders. There's around 400,000 men in total join the Freikorps out of an army of, you know, kind of like 8 million. So it's a pretty small kind of, a pretty small subsection. The Freikorps, I would propose to you, become a kind of alibi for the mainstream German armed forces. So when the German armed forces, again in the late 40s, are trying to explain what had happened during the Weimar Republic and in Nazi Germany, they say, well, back after the war, the violence that's committed, the atrocities that are committed against civilians, they weren't us, they were Freikorps. These are like volunteer desperados. You know, we can cordon them off from the honourable record of the German army, you know, through the ages. But really, if we drill down to who the Freikorps were, these are soldiers who, first of all, they volunteered to defend the Republic. So they're not like right-wing desperado proto-Nazis, as some of them later argue. So, I mean, after 1933, it becomes socially beneficial to have been like a pioneer Nazi. And so you get lots of very vibrant memoirs from Freikorps officers talking about, you know, how ferociously they'd hated Bolshevism and their dislike of female emancipation. And they're very kind of racy, famous. They're better thought of as fiction, I think, than memoirs. And just for listeners, a very interesting book by Klaus Teberleit called Male Fantasies that you should check out if this sounds interesting. In fact, as I say, most of these men volunteer to defend the Republic. The recruitment advertisements for the Freikorps are carried in the socialist press. So Vorwärts is the main SPD newspaper. So they're not being drawn from a pool of right-wing desperados. The papers describe them as government soldiers. And we've had an interesting analysis in the last few years of who actually the Freikorps people were. And it discovers that most of them are just working class soldiers. They can't get a job. They're drawn by excellent pay, superb pensions. There's no evidence that they're drawn by any kind of the appeal of any kind of crusade against socialism. Hardly any are ex-officers. So 3% of the Freikorps are ex-officers. It used to be thought that they were sort of top heavy with like highly ideological conservatives and nationalists. Hardly any, and only 2% at most of Freikorps personnel go on to join the Nazi SA or SS. So the idea there's some kind of like clean transmission mechanism from these, even the term Freikorps, we should probably dispose of, but I don't want to overload you with my myth-hating. The idea there's some kind of clean transmission belt from post-war violence against civilians through until 1933 via the SA, it doesn't really stack up either. So the Freikorps are the alibi of the Reichswehr.
So we talk a lot about the rise of Nazism and 23 in particular as a big key year. And something that's worth bearing in mind as an example of that is in November 1923, we get the Beer Hall Purge. And that actually sees another instance of executive power being briefly handed over. And that becomes a sort of, I've always felt it's a bit of a period of epoch change where we see one of those shifts in how the Wehrmacht sees itself and how it's seen by the state. Do you feel that that's the case? Do you feel that there's a sort of cultural or a self-awareness shift for it at that point?
I think 1923, absolutely right, is an important watershed. But I would see the important thing being the Franco-Belgian occupation of the Ruhr. So in early 23, the French have had enough of waiting for reparations in kind and payment. So they occupy Germany's industrial heartland to try and extract the coal themselves. The government declares as well-known passive resistance and it prints money to pay everybody's salary. So a bit like the furlough scheme during the COVID pandemic. And it basically bankrupts the economy. From the army's side, it's absolutely humiliated by this central part of Germany being occupied with complete impunity by French and Belgian troops. As a large amount of widely discussed sexual violence is perpetrated by the occupiers, and the army can do nothing. There's a belief that there's some kind of heroic military resistance against the Franco-Belgian occupation, but it really doesn't. It barely makes a ripple. So it's this experience, when it's not the army that's protecting German soil, it winds up being workers resisting passively. This is what really causes a rethink. The two kind of well-known uprisings in 1923, is one by the communists in October 23, and then one by the Nazis in November, I think both are real damp squibs. So in the communist case, much heralded, there's much of talk of it being like, you know, Germany's October 1917 revolution. It ends up being a disorganized assault on a few Hamburg police stations that's easily beaten back by the regular police. And then the Nazi putsch, the much storied Beer Hall putsch, this is put down even more quickly by units of the Bavarian state police. So there's no real kind of army involvement in it whatsoever. So 1923, I think, discredits the idea that the army can be an independent actor and protect German soil. And it also discredits the idea of putschism. because they've both been, you know, damp squibs, humiliating failures, no public support. And it's this that really brings about a change in the Reichswehr's orientation towards working more with other institutions in the Weimar Republic.
And that's really what we're sort of entering here. It's a sort of pragmatic period of sort of republicanism that goes through this era. There's a lot closer integration. I mean, one of the kind of things I see as iconic of that is when you start to get, I mean, it's October 1926, when we mentioned General Hans von Sect before, who again, like as we've talked about in the context of this, the army is Reich. It's still incredibly monarchist within itself. And that manifests repeatedly in multiple ways. But I'm going to give one version of what happens. And then I'd be really interested for you to almost provide the, what we'll call the Schleicher narrative or the Schleicher involvement as to how this plays out. Because I think this incident is a really good example of that kind of machinations that's going on. So the raw facts, or well, let's call them the raw facts, are essentially that in October 1926, without seeking government approval, von Sect invites the son of the former emperor, Wilhelm II, to attend army maneuvers in the uniform of the old imperial First Foot Guards. And this causes such a storm that eventually he's forced to resign. And that signals a changing of the guard in terms of who's in charge and who's controlling both the Reichswehr as a political entity, but also, to a certain extent, its strategic priorities as a force. Now, Would you like to tell the listeners about Schleicher, who he is, and how that situation might have been manufactured to a certain degree?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to defend Schleicher as being a paragon of virtue. And if you look at the Weimar Republic, there are very few kind of like inspirational, morally unburdened figures. But I think also that Schleicher was right to throw Sect to the wolves, because there's very, very little appetite for monarchism in Weimar Germany. So the very same year that von Sect commits this knowing faux pas, there's actually a referendum that's held in Germany on whether the royal families that are deposed in 1918 should be compensated for the loss of their property. And the idea they should be is resoundingly rejected by the electorate. So monarchism really is an extremely fringe force in the Republic, a cause for fringe, you know, starchy reactionaries like Sect or, you know, Franz von Papen. It's talked up afterwards. Like von Papen in his memoirs claims that if Germany had been able to hang on to the monarchy, we'd never have had a Hitler, which is utterly preposterous. So I think Schleicher's right to get rid of von Sect. And if I'm going to defend Schleicher, I'm going to say that Schleicher in the Nuremberg trials and in historiography has become something of a human shield for Hindenburg to avoid the things that happen after 1930 being, as they should be, pinned much more squarely to the historical record of the old field marshal. So it's Hindenburg that sets the parameters. I mean, Schleicher's just his military advisor. It's Hindenburg that says, no, we can't work with Social Democrats. We've got to protect the military budget, come what may, even in the midst of a Great Depression. It's Hindenburg that likes the idea of a Volksgemeinschaft, a people's community, that stokes the myth of 1918, that does more than anyone else to spread the lie that Germany had been stabbed in the back in 1918. So it's convenient to put down everything that goes wrong to Schleicher's maneuvering. It doesn't help that Schleicher's name translates to sneaker, which obviously is a nominative determinism that doesn't help his reputation. But really, it's Hindenburg we should be putting the boot into, not Schleicher.
And so, listeners, something to as Chris has explained, Schleicher is one of Hindenburg's key advisors at this point. He'll go on to effectively be chancellor, isn't he, in the end, before the end?
Absolutely, yeah. That illustrates beautifully how the point you made earlier about the army's way to the Republic. And in late 1932, both the Reich president and the Reich chancellor are career soldiers. So that illustrates perfectly, you know, the case you were making earlier.
And I think what I find interesting about the incident in 1926 is it, again, as you say, what we're seeing is there remains this element within the army that is still looking backwards almost, as well at the same time tactically and strategically looking forward. You know, we mentioned von Sect earlier. I mean, this guy who we are now booting out, or is being booted out because he's now seen as unattractively monarchist, let's say, for the army at this point, is also arguably the father of a lot of the tactical innovation and everything else that will go into making the Wehrmacht, its successor organization, so effective. So
it's almost like there's a cultural looking backwards to imperialism, but also within the army itself, genuine innovation and decisions being made on how would a future war be fought. A lot of the internal conflicts strategically in the army at this time, for example, are around, are we going to have to fight on two fronts again? What kind of war should we be fighting? What kind of army, once we inevitably get the limitations of Versailles lifted, what should the future German forces look like? And I always find that quite fascinating with the Reichswehr is there's almost those two massive internal and external battles going on at the same time. There's what does the future of Germany's armed forces look like? And there's what does the future of Germany look like and what role do we have within it?
Yeah, so and this changes kind of like under von Seyss. I'd hold back from giving him too much personal credit, but so there's a strand in the Reichswehr from the mid-20s that recognizes that the old sergeant major state of, you know, pre-1914 is gone forever, you know, when kind of Junkers lorded it over the rest of society, and that what is needed now is a kind of like modern managerial hybrid approach to rearmament that draws in other institutions of the state. That looks beyond this kind of rather narrow pool of embittered monarchists that certainly the earlier sort of right wing headbangers in the Reichswehr would prefer. So you get a belief that the army's job should be to spread military values, to remilitarize German society, to work with universities. So one of the things that Reichswehr does is it creates a new academic discipline called defense studies, which kind of like brings together geographers, historians, political scientists to work out, you know, a much more scientific and technocratic way of waging warfare. You've got the Black Reichswehr you mentioned. It sounds a bit Freikorpsy and illicit, but really it's a set of clandestine border defense formations that are there to augment the army, but they're really run by the individual German states. They're not run by the army itself, and they're not anti-republican. So one of the most fervently pro-Republican Reich chancellors of the entire Weimar period is a guy called Josef Wirt from the Center Party, and he is very pleased to be known as the father of the Black Reichswehr. So they are working with the institutions of the state in the mid-1920s. They're looking towards a societal remilitarization that can complement the still pared-down numbers of the Reichswehr proper. So it's a much broader concept. It's a much more ambitious horizon of expectation than Seyss, who's still a little bit stuck in this kind of like with his monocle in the pre-1914 era.
And this was one of the reasons I really wanted to do an episode on this in particular, and again why I wanted to have yourself on, is because it just there's such an oversimplification of the narratives around this. And people who are watching this, if you're noticing my screen suddenly shaking, that is because a small torty cat has just decided that she wants to attack the monitor. So listeners, you'll just have to assume there was a small torty assault there.
I won't take it personally.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she's a Reichswehr traditionalist. So, I mean, it's such a diverse, even within it as an organization, is that there's conflicting ideas, there's conflicting priorities, and there's self-conflicting beliefs within individuals as well. I mean, we've not really touched much on Hindenburg, really, and we should talk about Hindenburg's role. Maybe we don't talk about his post sort of 1930s role yet, but what's Hindenburg doing within this period?
Yeah, so Hindenburg is a very, very venerable field marshal who fought in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870. Then he retires. He's called back by the German government in 1914. In 1915, he wins a kind of set of ringing and famous victories on the Eastern Front against the Russians at Tannenburg and the Masurian Lake. And this gives him a rather unfair reputation as being a military genius. Really, it's Ludendorff, his quartermaster general, who's like the brains of the outfit, shall we say. But Hindenburg is also, and this is something that's come out in recent research, quite a shrewd politician. So he's very, very careful to preserve the mythos that accrues around him after 1914 and to avoid becoming implicated in any sort of like adverse decision. So famously in 1919, there's a big debate amongst the German political classes whether to sign the Versailles Treaty. And there's quite a few hotheads on the right saying, no, we can't sign it. It's a death sentence for German honor. We must fight. Even if we go down, you know, it'll be beautiful. And it's time for for the army to tell the politicians that we can't do anything against an Entente invasion that's got tanks and mechanized infantry. We're just going to get crushed. But Hindenburg doesn't tell them. He tells Wilhelm Groener, his subordinate, you go and talk to the civilian politicians. And then conveniently, a few months later, Hindenburg turns up in the Reichstag for a commission on the causes of German defeat and says, ah, we could have won easily. We were stabbed in the back by the home front. So really quite a wretchedly disloyal act by Hindenburg towards Groener. But it protects his mythos, which he attends to as a custodian carefully. Then in 1925, he gets elected quite narrowly as the Reich president. And suddenly you've got an old school, definitely a monarchist, but also a populist nationalist increasingly, who is in charge. It's a very, very powerful role under the Weimar Constitution. So the president can declare when an emergency is, can send in troops, can decide who gets to sit in cabinets. And you've got this person at the apex of society, very, very popular. His influence is amplified by a media. So this is an era when you've got lots of kind of illustrated weeklies that give people a sense of real personal connection to Hindenburg. And his charisma becomes a decisive factor in the fate of the Republic from the late 20s onwards.
And it creates this conflict as we move into the mid-20s and beyond now. It's, again, we've got this evolving situation both within the Reichswehr, but we've got this evolving situation within Germany as well, because we're now looking at a period where you've got the rise of the SDP within Germany, and really the Reichswehr having to try and work out how it accommodates itself with a political leadership that's more left leaning, that's the leftist side of things, and how it deals with that.
Yeah, so this is a real kind of like a real liminal moment. It's sort of like a what might have been, I think, in German history. So for a while, the Reichswehr thinks it can work with the SPD. The SPD is not like, it's not like the German communists, you know, like a completely committed to socialization of the means of production. It's a pretty reformist outfit. It's really content with a sort of providing a larger welfare safety net.
It's what we describe as soft left today, isn't it?
Yeah, I think probably a little bit harder than soft left, but I mean, in principle, the SPD was committed to Marxism. In practice, long since let that go. But there was an anti-militarist aspect to the SPD, or a wing that disheartened, I think it's fair to say, the Reichswehr. So one of the SPD chancellors, a guy called Philipp Scheidemann, makes a speech in the Reichstag in 1926 using his parliamentary immunity to expose covert arms trafficking between Germany and Russia. So this is under the Rapallo Treaty of 22. There have been all kinds of entanglements. And this is seen as evidence that you can't really trust a social democrat. Then in 1928, there's an election campaign in which one of the SPD's main slogans is, let's save our money for children, not for battleships, which obviously sickens the Reichswehr. There could be no more objectionable slogan. And the SPD does incredibly well in that election. It's returned as the top party, more than twice the vote of anybody else. And this starts to convince the Reichswehr that, okay, so the SPD is campaigning on an anti-militarist ticket. It's been returned as the biggest party. Maybe elections are our problem after all. This makes it much more receptive to the prospectus of the anti-republican right that kind of rather do away with elections and have a setup with a Führer who doesn't have to stoop to having himself affirmed by the ballot box, but instead enjoys a kind of a populist mandate from the masses. So this is what really leads the Reichswehr into the Nazi embrace a few years later.
And this is why I was keen to kind of stress to people that when we talk Reichswehr, we're not just talking about the army, because that, you know, it's battleship fear as a wider bracket for military and spending in general. That is, as you say, one of those drivers that kind of turns around and goes, actually, maybe we can't work with these guys. Maybe that whole democracy thing, it's okay in principle, but you know, budgets are budgets. But I mean, that brings us almost nicely to how this plays out and where this sits in terms of that. How does the Nazi side of things, as Hitler rises, as the Nazis rise, how do they start to cement that relationship with the Reichswehr?
Yes, so there's an overlap of kind of interest. So both want to dispose of a left-leaning Weimar state. They don't necessarily repudiate democracy, so the idea that the people aren't still the ultimate wellspring of power. And this sets them apart from von Seeckt, who really saw authority as being vested in sort of like God and royalty. So the Nazis still think in terms of the demos, but they define it in kind of racial terms. So it's the so-called Aryans are the people that are that give authority. And the army can work with this because it still gives a broad societal platform for the kind of military effort that had been seen in the First World War that did enroll all the other groups in society. The Nazis and the Reichswehr have an intersection in disliking parliaments because, as you say, you know, they vote through budgets, they can make things difficult. Parliaments have oversight over military affairs. So the army is quite happy with a setup where you've got a strong government that has some kind of claim to populist legitimacy and that will lead a much more emphatic remilitarization of society, won't allow these kind of pacifist sentiments or these tedious concerns about state budgets to stand in the way. And then when the Nazis start to do well in elections after 1930, it looks very much like this is a group we can work with. Sure, you know, for a lot of the traditional army, they look down on the Nazis culturally as being a bit plebeian and distasteful and prone to making, you know, populist statements in parliament. But they see essentially, you know, a solid right-wing, healthily militaristic movement that they should be co-opting and working with. It's difficult for them to do, but this intersection is very key to explaining how the end game happens in 1933.
And that almost brings us, you know, the final lead into that end game is really when we get into the Reichstag elections of sort of July 1932. So this is where we finally the Nazi Party become the largest party. And this is also the point where up until now you've had almost that relationship we talked about Schleicher. This is almost where the power shift happens to a certain extent. And the army realized they need to almost be more proactively political within the Reichstag itself if they're going to remain being the leader in that dialogue, not the follower.
Yeah, so I mean the army is pretty sure that its back's covered by having Hindenburg as the president. So Hindenburg gets re-elected in 1932. So there's another 7 years. This happens before the Nazis' big election result. So after July 1932, the Nazis are the biggest party, the biggest vote they'd ever get in free elections, so 37% of the population. But Hindenburg still refuses to appoint Hitler as a chancellor with full powers. So he says, I don't want to, you know, privately, he says, I don't want to give full powers to this kind of corporal from Austria. And in public, he says that, you know, I can't trust the Nazi movement to use these powers in a broad and pluralistic way, which for once Hindenburg, you know, was correct. So then Schleicher takes over as chancellor later on in the year. So after the episode of von Papen, we don't really have time to go into, but a pop-in Jay. And Schleicher thinks, well, if Hitler's not going to play ball, then how about I try and peel away some elements from Hitler's movement? So the ones around Gregor Strasser, who was one of the Nazis' key organizers. Because there's a large part of the Nazi movement that is getting pretty impatient with Hitler's refusal to accept a vice chancellorship or a lower post in government. And Schleicher tries to peel them away, and also the German trade union movement. So he's attempting to create a more ambitious coalition that stretches far more into the socialist camps of life than his predecessors had done. And there was a chance this could have worked out. I recent research suggests that right up until the 30th of January, when Hitler's appointed, Hindenburg's option of sticking with Schleicher with a coalition with Gregor Strasser might just have fended the Nazis off. But by this stage, Hindenburg is an old man. He's tiring of rolling constitutional crises. He quite likes a lot of the Nazi ideology. And in the end, he's just fine, you know, I'll appoint Hitler. But it's a complete betrayal by Hindenburg of the people who voted for him against Hitler earlier in the year. And this is what I really want to get across, that, you know, Hindenburg, however tired and weary he might have been, stabs a lot of folk in the back in January 1933.
That's it. He's meant to be the backstop protection against this. It's a thing absolutely. He effectively runs yeah. on. And he absolutely fails to do it. And I do think that gets overlooked a fair bit. I mean, something that you talked about there, Chris, as well, about like people might be thinking, well, Schleicher, as we've described in earlier in this episode, is this sort of old aristocratic German officer. Why would on earth would some of the socialist side and
that working class side see him as someone they could work with? Well, one, he's an incredibly effective political operator and always has been and always was. But also, I mean, one of my favorite stories about him is he was a master of effectively what they called low dialect. He was one of those people who, in modern terms, his accent would shift based on who he was talking to. So if he was chatting to someone with a Berlin accent, by the end of that conversation, he's chatting with a Berlin accent. He does that mirroring thing. And I always think that, again, like we need to be very careful not to pigeonhole people into good person, bad person. This person's an aristocrat and can only talk to other aristocrats. And this person's a Marxist and can only talk to other Marxists. This whole period is a period of shifting alliances, of shifting beliefs and shifting compromises. And ultimately, that's what results in the path that's traveled down. But it doesn't mean there weren't ways things that could have gone differently along the way.
No, absolutely. Very well put. Yeah, but this is a kind of a period where everyone is a different shade of grey. You can't look for kind of like good and evil. It's sort of, you know, people in situations they don't fully comprehend. People get trapped into certain path political dependencies. There are definitely villains. Hitler clearly is a villain. The Nazi leaders are clearly villains. Hindenburg, I'd add to that. But a lot of other people are trying to make the best they can. They want to preserve as much of 1920s liberal democracy as is possible. They want to keep the army as an independent factor from the Nazis. So some honourable people in the trade unions and in other institutions of the state make decisions that, looked at in retrospect, historians regret, and they also regret, such as voting for Hitler's Enabling Act. But there's a moral clarity, you know, with we know what happened and they didn't at the time. And the moral judgment on past people is quite a cheap commodity unless you can contextualize how they were making their decision.
I think that's always the case. I think that's just because the way things turned out is not the inevitable way they were going to be. And the real danger is in is looking at things with the benefit of hindsight and going, they could have gone different ways. And also, as you say, I think it is a useful thing to highlight different characters that exist within that period. I mean, one of mine I always come back to is General Kurt von Hammerstein-Eckford, who is a fascinating character. I mean, he's proper old guard Prussian military aristocracy and looks it. You know, the kind of man who valued having a dueling scar. And he's been in, you know, he joins the army school in age 10, like after being born in 1893. And he fights in World War One. He's a feature of the Reichswehr all the way through. And he's retained in the Reichswehr because thanks to his father-in-law, who is General von Luttwitz, who is part of that coup we talked about earlier in the episode. And Luttwitz assumes he will join him in that coup, and he doesn't. And Hammerstein, to me, epitomizes that thing of where you can have these people in the army who aren't particularly pleased with the Republic. They're not particularly pleased with the direction of travel, with the rise of socialism, with any of this stuff. But as you say, they have that loyalty to the Reich. They have that loyalty to the state, and they are unwilling to break what they see as an oath to that. And that persists for him all the way through. I mean, when Schleicher is killed ultimately by the Nazis in the Night of the Long Knives in 1934, they go to extreme efforts to prevent people from attending his funeral. Von Hammerstein Eckord is one of the guys who turns up in full uniform and insists on being allowed through. Now, Hitler will court him throughout the period to try and make him one of the icons of this because he represents that old school army. But he's one of the guys, I mean, he dies early in World War II after being effectively sidelined because it's very emphatically clear on multiple occasions that he's trying to plot against Hitler. Those characters exist with those complexities to them. We have a tendency to flatten out in the past. I mean, one of my, without going into it too much, one of my favorite things about him is it's difficult to prove, but he is almost certainly one of at least three people who swore to Hitler's face and told him to F off up there with Mannerheim and that. So, but yeah, I mean, it's a complex period with complex characters, and that brings us, I suppose, into we need to just, as a way of wrapping up, look at what happens after 1933. So how does this body as we know it change and morph to become what becomes the Wehrmacht? So let's 1933, the full Nazi era is now underway. What are the things, Chris, that Hitler does, that government does to effectively ensure that the Reichswehr is now loyal and that switch to the Wehrmacht can happen?
Yes, so I'll have to do this quite quickly. There's a lot to say, but soon after Hitler's appointed chancellor, he has a meeting at Hammerstein's home, actually, in which he kind of like sets out his vision for Germany's military future. So initially, it's a typical kind of Hitler rant and harangue hour about his odyssey from Austria to Germany, kind of boilerplate stuff. But then he makes a couple of commitments that, firstly, he can't see that rearmament can be sustained in the long term on a transactional basis of imports and exports. So Germany needs too many raw materials. It can't be stuck in this capitalist model of balances of trade. And therefore, in the medium to long term, the only way that Germany's going to get the resources it needs to build armaments is conquest and Lebensraum. So this is quite a contrast to Hitler's first public broadcasters as Reich Chancellor, and it's all, you know, I'm a man of peace, you know, I want everyone to disarm, you know, we can all live together happily. This is the real outlook. So Hitler promises that the army that he will have their back, that he will rearm as much as can be done under the existing constraints of international trade. In the medium term to long term, he'll launch a social militarization of society. So he'll revive the spirit, the mythologized spirit of the Wilhelmine Age. So this is enough to bring them on side. And he says, don't worry about parliaments, that's all gone now. You know, kind of, but we've got your back. And then we're going to introduce conscription again as soon as we can get away with it. We're going to peel away from the entire apparatus of the League of Nations. And in the long run, it was clear there was going to be a racialized war in the East against Russia. There's very kind of broad buy-in for this.
There are plenty of army officers after the war who'll claim, well, we never bought into that bit. I mean, that's absolutely emphatically not true, is it? There's a considerable appreciation and acknowledgement and acceptance and desire for that within areas of the army.
Absolutely, yeah. So, I mean, we can see the period from 33 to 39 is a six-year preparation on the army's part to fight a war of extermination in the East, not so much in the West, but there, no doubt whatsoever. If you listen to these people at Nuremberg, it's like, oh no, we just wanted to, you know, defend our homeland in a professional, technocratic way. But there's a very deep bind. The army has become obsessed with Judeo-Bolshevism. It buys into sort of stab in the back myths that hold Jews responsible for the German defeat. A lot of the foreign policy platform in Mein Kampf would not have been out of place. So absolute nonsense to think there's no kind of like very, very proximate intersection of interests, even as early as 1933, with a few exceptions, but this is, you know, it's pretty hegemonic.
And throughout this period, or certainly in this period, certainly in 33 and heading into 34, you've got this growing conflict or rival within, almost for Hitler's affection, loyalty, and control with the SA, haven't you? The sort of I always call them the Aldi paramilitary arm of the German state, as opposed to as the Nazis, as opposed to the SS. So we talked earlier about Freikorps and all of that. I mean, if you're not familiar with the SA, think of them in that way, but with a very Nazi bent. They are that sort of paramilitary arm of the party. And there's a real worry within the Reichswehr, isn't there, that they're the people who might then drive almost military direction for the Nazis rather than the Reichswehr itself.
Yes, I mean, the SA is at least 400,000 men strong by 1934, and many more if you include other organizations that are like forcefully folded into it. So it's much larger than the Reichswehr. And Ernst Röhm, the head of the SA, certainly has the ambition to create a vast people's army in which the SA would kind of like would organize, but that there would still be a place for the Reichswehr on the technical side in sort of weapons and strategy. But this obviously dismays the Reichswehr, because one of the things about an army is that it needs to protect its monopoly over the use of military force. So a rival regime is extremely unsettling to it. So it hatches an agreement with Hitler before 1934 that if he takes care of the SA and these hotheads and the brown shirts that are marching around Germany threatening a second revolution, then they will basically come fully into the Nazi fold. They will swear a personal allegiance to him, and he doesn't have to worry anymore about the loyalty of this other kind of pillar of the German state.
And this ultimately leads to the army oath to Hitler in August 1934. I mean, I almost feel like that's almost a good sort of end point for us in terms of saying, well, that's at that point,
it is an element of a fait accompli. This is the direction has changed. The road is set for the Reichswehr itself. But maybe we should there's plenty of time between 1934 and 1939. And maybe that's one we'll cover in a different way is the Wehrmacht going into World War II. But I suppose a final question I might pose to you is if an observer was looking in 1939 and looking at the Wehrmacht as it was then, how much of what they were seeing do you feel is the result of the pre-1934 Reichswehr? Like what elements of continuity is still there and what would they feel is different?
It's a very good question. In ideological terms, it probably wouldn't seem too kind of wildly different. So you've got the same kind of basic premise of sure, messianic sense of German might, a pride in Germany's history as a military entity. The anti-Semitism would be far more in the foreground in 39 than it would have been before 1934. So there'd always been, most research suggests, the research is a little bit thin, but there'd always been within army culture kind of like an aversion to Jews. I wouldn't call it anti-Semitism in the modern context, but a kind of aversion. This has become very, very much more foreground by 1939. It's pinned with a broader kind of conceptualization of the social order in terms of race. So by 1939, the German army doesn't think so much in terms of borders and provinces. It thinks in terms of space and race. There were some antecedents of this in the First World War, particularly on the Eastern Front, but this, I think, is the thing that will really kind of stand out. If you could interview an ordinary Wehrmacht soldier in 39 compared to a Reichswehr soldier from 31, this would be the key thing, I think, that stood out.
And I think that is a good point for us to leave off here. And hopefully, listeners, what you've come away with is an understanding that this is a vast area of unpicked stuff. And we have a tendency, I think, in certainly in military history, but also in social history, to almost, as I say, wobbly lines it from the end of World War One up to probably about 1923, then up again to 1934, and then again up until into World War Two. And it's almost like, you know, the old meme where you go, yeah, well, we have the Imperial Army, then you have three question marks as your second bullet point, and then you have the Wehrmacht. And hopefully what you've got from this, listeners, is a realization that the Reichswehr is an incredibly interesting body and one that is worth your time to dig into and look into. I mean, Chris, other than where people can find yourself and do tell us again on that one, but what do you recommend people should read or look into if they want to know more about this?
I would. I have a book coming out later this year on the Weimar Republic that looks at the Reichswehr. But I would suggest there's a book by Wolfram Vetter on the Wehrmacht myth and reality that looks at the pre-1933 belief system and then kind of maps it to post-1933. And it picks up the continuity of authoritarianism, anti-Semitism, kind of like obsession with Russia, Bolshevism. And also points forward to something we haven't really discussed is the extent of the Wehrmacht's criminality and involvement in the Holocaust in the Second World War, which is all kind of like papered over in the late 1940s. So Wolfram Vetter's book is very important. And there's an Oxford History of the Weimar Republic that's coming out that's got a really good chapter on the Reichswehr by Benjamin Seemann, one of the leading historians. And if you can get hold of that, that'll be a very good takeaway to get a sense of what the latest state of play is in the research in the field.
Thank you very much for that. I mean, what I would do is I'll make sure we've got some bits on that. I mean, and some of what you just said up there, we're going to pick up in the extra bit in a second because I find it fascinating. But thank you everyone for watching and listening. And just a general reminder that if you enjoyed this, Chris and I are going to talk a bit more now about various things because we're going to continue geeking out for a bit. If you want the full version of that, you can get that by going to untitled-history.com and becoming, joining our, diving down our rabbit hole and becoming a member there. And also it is incredibly useful if you review this podcast on your podcast app of choice. Reviews are what your podcast app will be using to recommend things to other people. So give us a rating, give us a review. It really helps us get the word out. And just genuinely, if you've enjoyed this, share it with someone who is offline. Ping them a link on WhatsApp. Just let them know via email or mention it in your office. Do something because it's all useful. You've been listening to the Untitled History Podcast, a Battle Guide production. If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to support the podcast, why not head over to our dedicated supporter page? There, for the cost of a cup of tea, you can decide which subjects we cover next, get access to exclusive behind-the-scenes content, and join a community of like-minded people. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. And Chris, I always start this by saying, what is the thing we didn't talk about that you wish we'd really had time to dive into?
The stab in the back myth, yeah. after 1918. So this is the big lie of the Weimar Republic. It becomes like a meta narrative that explains everything about Germany's plight, and it's nonsense on any kind of like empirical level. So after April 1917, when the German government.
You have been listening to the Extra Bit on the Untitled History Podcast. If what you have heard there is a thing you want to hear more of, then I'm sorry it faded out, but what you will have to do is back us, and then you can find out more. So don't forget to back us at theuntitled-history.com for more of what you've heard here and more extra episodes in future. Dirk Ebert and General William...
I'm going to really struggle with that German name.
Gewerner.
It's
my pronunciation's pretty poor, so yeah. Don't.
I will be apologizing for it at the beginning.
Ha!